I'm Tim Yeo. I'm the Executive Chairman of Powerhouse Energy. Welcome to this podcast, the first one of what will be a series, which we're going to put up on our website. And I've got with me my colleague, Kirsty Gogan, who's joined the board last September. Welcome, Kirsty.
Oh, delighted to be here, Tim. Thanks.
Just say a bit about yourself so one knows who you are, what your background is.
Oh, sure. Well, career-wise, I've been very fortunate to work in across all the sectors, really, government, industry, non-profit sectors, and I actually have a consulting firm and an NGO, in addition to being a board member here at Powerhouse Energy. But all of my work really is focused on climate change and the environment. So that's the golden thread that pulls it all together.
Great. Well, we're delighted to have you with us. I'll just begin by saying what I think lies ahead for Powerhouse Energy in 2021. Last year, 2020, was a year of transformation for the company, but we're not letting up on the pace at all. If anything, it's going to accelerate. First and foremost, in 2021, we need to reach financial close on the SPV, the Special Project Vehicle, which will actually build our first commercial scale plant up in Cheshire at Protos. And I expect financial close to be reached during Q2. And then we'll get underway with the construction. In fact, we're already, because of our very strong financial position after a very successful fundraise in January, we are able to order any big items of kit that we need, which may have a long lead time. So we're making preparations. But we'll get on with the construction this year. Our expectation is we will complete the building of that first plant and have it operational in Q1 2022. Obviously, we're going to drive it forward as fast as we can, so if we can improve on that, we will. But I think that's a realistic target date. In addition to that, we will be identifying the sites of our second and third plants in the UK. And later in the year, I will report on the progress made in terms of planning consents and so on for those two very interesting sites. But we're not letting the grass grow under our feet by just sticking to the UK. Before Christmas, we announced the heads of terms with our Polish partners, HUI, and they are taking things forward in Poland. We've identified a city which wants to be the host site for the first 10 of our plants in Poland, and negotiations are well underway there, not only with the city authorities, but also with a very large engineering company, which we hope may join in this project and accelerate the pace at which it can be rolled out. Those negotiations are continuing, so we can't be more specific about it. Anyhow, I'm pleased with the progress in Poland. And of course, we are already in discussions with several other territories around the world in three different continents. And so we expect to be progressing overseas at the same time as we continue the construction process here in the UK.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's really incredible, actually, to sort of see the pace with which we're developing and commercializing, and we'll be, you know, basically operating this technology as soon as next year in the UK. And the other thing that's really exciting about this, I think, is how scalable it is. That, you know, this first commercial plant in the plastic park is already going to make a really important contribution towards, you know, two of our big challenges: addressing non-recyclable plastic waste, which sadly, you know, I'm afraid globally often does end up in our oceans, shockingly, but then also will make an incredible contribution towards delivering some of the hydrogen fuel that we'll need to, you know, to enable the fuel switching in our transport fleet in particular. That's going to be really necessary if we're going to stay on track towards meeting our net zero targets. So the beauty of this is that, you know, we can roll this out, you know, in many, many locations around the UK, but then it's completely transferable to all of these global markets, you know, and that's why I think we're seeing this kind of appetite from Poland and from many, many countries around the world that are grappling with many of these same challenges.
I hope this is going to be the year when PHE does start to be recognised, because we've got a much higher public profile now, does start to be recognised as a technology company which has got solutions, as Kirsty has just said, to two of the biggest and most urgent environmental problems facing the world: the problem of how to dispose of plastic waste, far too much of which goes into the sea in some parts of the world, and how to produce more low-carbon energy, critical to our response to the climate change challenge. And also, perhaps just worth mentioning as well, that if hydrogen starts to be used more widely as a transport fuel for particularly for buses and lorries, that will produce an immediate benefit in terms of air quality in urban areas wherever this technology is used. There's one thing I'd like to mention, Kirsty, because I think it's relevant to the ESD committee, which you chair at PHE, which with your inspiration we set up at the end of last year. One of the Sustainable Development Goals, Goal 14, is life below water. Mm. And it was interesting that one of the surveys showed, I think, more than 360 companies had been analysed for the SDGs, which they're actually making progress towards. Only one of them was able to claim they were really contributing materially to reaching SDG 14. Of right. course, that's a claim which I think we will be able to make when yeah. we start to get into volume production, particularly in territories, some of which I'm afraid are in Asia, where an awful lot of this waste is still being dumped in the sea.
Well, this is the thing, and it's something that I'm really aware of, having, you know, spent my career working in sort of environmental sustainability. I've been increasingly ending up being dominated by the issue of climate change and, you know, carbon intensity of our energy system and of our whole economy. But this isn't the only environmental problem that we need to take seriously, and that is, you know, presenting a real threat to biodiversity and ultimately to the ecosystems upon which we depend as well. So, you know, this technology, the fact that it does have these multiple benefits that you're describing, that, you know, it can help really make a very significant contribution towards reducing ocean plastic waste, whilst also, you know, producing a supply of hydrogen that will be needed to support that transition in our transport fleet, I think is really exciting. I mean, hopefully the plastic waste that we produce in the UK doesn't end up in the sea, but we are also banned from sending it abroad to be processed elsewhere. And for the non-recyclable plastic, for the plastic that really comes to the end of its life, the only real solution that we have right now is either to bury it in the ground, which has, you know, climate implications because of the greenhouse gases that it eventually emits as it degrades, or burning it in incinerators. And, you know, the incineration itself also contributes, of course, to air quality issues. One of the things that I think we've learned over this really difficult year dealing with COVID-19 has been to shine a light on the importance of air quality for health. So if we can eliminate that contribution towards bad air by no longer having to incinerate that end of life plastic, but actually also produce hydrogen that can, you know, take away some of these very bad transport related emissions as well. I think this is a very serious public health benefit in addition to the important environmental contribution.
Let's just talk a bit more about hydrogen, I think, because I was struck when the International Energy Agency, my friend Fatih Birol, the executive director, said a few weeks ago, to keep under the 1.5 degree centigrade temperature rise, which was the target set in the Paris Accord, there needs to be globally a 90-fold increase in hydrogen production capacity by 2030. And that's an incredibly rapid growth. Now, I mean, you and I, Kirsty, have shared a close interest in nuclear, which, if you look back to the last century, Britain was a leader in nuclear technology. And sadly, we let that slip, I'm afraid. We didn't. Governments, I'm afraid, of both parties were inconsistent in their attitude towards nuclear. We're waking up a bit now, but we'll never get back to where we were then. Obviously, Britain is proud of the fact that we're the world's leading country at deploying offshore wind turbines. But until very recently, hardly any of that kit was made in this country either. Now, what we're looking at PHE is a British technology, which we intend to deploy around the world. So it's effectively a type of export. And this technology could make a significant contribution to the expansion of the UK's hydrogen production capacity. What do you think the government is really going to do in terms of its hydrogen strategy? How will it take all this forward?
The scale of production that's going to be needed, it's equivalent to the current oil and gas markets. That's 100 million barrels of oil per day that we use right now, just for oil flows. So the scale of production is just astonishing. And then we have to obviously achieve that within an incredibly compressed timescale. You know, we're working now with 29 years to 2050 to achieve this transition. And so there has to be, you know, a commitment to developing all of the tools that are at our disposal. And one of the things that I think is really empowering about the PHE technology, the Powerhouse Energy technology, is the opportunity for local authorities to actually, you know, take ownership of this issue and create a closed loop solution for multiple challenges that they already face, like disposing of this plastic waste, but also making a real contribution towards enabling the really near term transition for their own fuel consumption in terms of the, you know, the trucks and the buses and, you know, the transport fleet that's used right now locally. That's one of the great advantages, I think, and is very, very scalable for that reason, because it's so anchored in local communities, enabling local decision makers to really take ownership of the opportunity here.
Yes, I mean, I think it's absolutely right, and worth stressing that our partnership with Peel, who've got a lot of experience at working with local authorities in various types of infrastructure projects, including, but not exclusively, waste to energy projects. They've identified across the UK 77 sites which are suitable for our plants. Many of those will be on local authority land or land where local authorities have either a refuse fleet, a refuse lorry fleet, or a bus depot, and so on. If we can locate our plants in those, co-locate really, then you do get a very nice sort of circular process that a fleet of buses goes out in the day, comes back, fleet of refuse lorries goes out on the gate, comes back with some plastic, put it through our plant, they refuel. And so it all works very nicely. And the relationships which we have, but particularly which Peel have with local authorities, mean that they will be very much among our partners as we deploy the technology across the UK.
Well, that's the thing. And those multiplier benefits and the business case and the, you know, the ability to, you know, accelerate the deployment of this technology, it's ready today, I think are major advantages in, you know, near term accelerating of this solution set. So, you know, this is, it's a near term, it's a solution that's available today. And I don't think all of our, you know, for the hydrogen production plans that we have, many of the technologies that we hopefully will be able to use in the future aren't actually available today, or at least they're not available cost competitively today. And, you know, that's a real challenge that we face down the track. But in the meantime, we do have technologies that are available today that we can deploy now and start to really address these issues.
It's a very important point, I think, that Kirsty's just made, because we will be able to roll this technology out quickly, and we're not going with a begging bowl to the Treasury saying we must have a subsidy. We welcome the fact that other people are also going to be producing hydrogen. That is extremely good news for the UK economy and for the world in terms of climate change. But in the very short term, there's no doubt, I think, that the Treasury will be particularly pleased to have a prospect of some hydrogen production, which does not require the taxpayer to dip their hands in their pocket. Because if you want to get something going very quickly, particularly in the current financial situation, I think to have one which stands on its own feet financially is going to be a huge advantage.
It really is. It really is. And especially when it's solving, you know, solving many of the big challenges that local authorities are facing, which is how to reduce local air pollution, which, you know, people are more and more concerned about, quite rightly, how to solve this question about non-recyclable plastic, and then also start making their real contribution towards the net zero transition.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're quite right. Of course, you link the air quality issues directly with health. I mean, I know we're no longer in the EU, which is a sadness for me, but London wasn't even meeting the EU standards for air quality, or at least parts of it weren't. And I think that the pandemic obviously has made people very conscious about all sorts of health issues. And there's a direct relationship between life expectancy and air quality. And we've seen, again, in Asia, particularly in China, the middle class is really getting upset. They've lifted themselves out of poverty, they've got children who've been educated, for a lot of them until recently there's only one child, but that child's life expectancy is reduced by the fact that the air quality is so bad. That's an issue here in the UK as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Traffic is a big factor, you know, and it's it affects everybody, you know. It doesn't matter really how wealthy you are, or, you know, which neighbourhood you live in, you know, unfortunately air pollution, you know, is... In fact, there was a study recently that shows that the premature deaths from air pollution are much higher than previously thought. And we're now looking at more than 8 million people every year dying as a result of air pollution. You know, this is just an epidemic. It's a pandemic, in fact, of, you know, epic proportions. The World Health Organization has previously said it's the world's biggest environmental threat. So it is time to start really taking that seriously. And, you know, just to put some numbers on it, so the powerhouse energy technology will take around 40 tons per day of waste plastic, which is about a third of the plastic waste generated in a city the size of Liverpool, for example, each day, and can turn that into around 2 tons of hydrogen per day. And that is enough to power 60 lorries to travel around 250 to 300 miles per day, which is kind of extraordinary when you think about it. So, you know, that's 60 fewer lorries traveling, you know, hundreds of miles every day without emissions. So, you know, I'm really all in favor of scaling that as fast as we can.
Well, that's certainly what we're going to try and do during 2021. And the contribution to air quality is right up there alongside our ability to tackle the plastic waste problem and our commitment to more low-carbon energy. I mean, looking further ahead, Kirsty, do you see us being able to work really with government in terms of trying to get faster progress towards a hydrogen economy? I think our contribution is likely to be particularly in the terms of supplying transport fleets. But it may also be that the government's already committed to having a hydrogen-powered town, so we get off the old natural gas-based system. Yeah. There's a role for us to supply that as well, really, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's many direct applications of hydrogen that are really interesting. We can put up to 20% hydrogen into our gas networks today. So there's an immediate near-term opportunity to start decarbonizing our heat networks. And then, of course, in transport as well, it's a very nice fuel, very clean, emissions-free fuel for heavy transport fleets, which is going to be one of our big challenges. It's very hard to decarbonize those otherwise. They're difficult to electrify. So the question is really, how do you kind of create the right balance of supply and demand? Because one of the challenges of achieving a big switch like this in your transport fleet is that you have to guarantee that you're going to be able to supply enough hydrogen. And I think that's where Powerhouse is really interesting, because it is this technology that's available today and can be very anchored in local communities, so it doesn't require, you know, national hydrogen enabled pipelines, you know, storage and distribution systems, because hydrogen is difficult to store and distribute. So being able to produce it locally is actually a really important benefit. Working with government is going to be, you know, really critical, sort of ensuring that, you know, multiple government departments really see the value of this technology to produce sustainable hydrogen, and ensuring that really it's given the recognition, I think, that it deserves for the contribution that it can make towards addressing all of these issues that we're describing. It doesn't fit easily into one of the sort of rainbow of, you know, hydrogen colors, blue and green and turquoise and so on. So, you know, we do need to really think carefully about how to advocate for the particular benefits of, you know, using this end of life, non-recyclable waste stream to turn it into this incredibly valuable commodity that's going to be absolutely central to our net zero targets.
And I think there's one area where we do hope that government will be giving a bit of a lead. That's in accelerating the spread of hydrogen fueling stations. I mean, it'd be nice to think that every motorway service area could have one of our plants there producing hydrogen, which then long distance truck drivers and so on could stop and fill up with hydrogen. It's that sort of, I mean, we're not asking government for money, but we do want them to give a lead in terms of showing that there's a need for this infrastructure, and that therefore, you know, every refueling spot can't just be petrol. It soon won't be diesel, I'm sure, but it needs a hydrogen facility there as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is the, you know, absolutely vital role that government can play. Is not just about, you know, handing out money, but actually the facilitative actions supporting investment in the associated infrastructure like you're describing, Tim, I think, you know, is, you know, something that's a low cost and very high benefit activity for government really to take seriously and consider the role that they're playing in enabling this rollout and this switch. And the associated infrastructure is going to be fundamentally important to create the confidence really, you know, amongst the users to actually make that leap.
Just finally, looking overseas, because of the flexibility of our technology, there may be some parts of the world where just to be able to produce power, electricity, in remote areas, which are really countries which don't have a grid which covers even some sizable towns, the facility to have a distributed generator, which can be just plonked down in a town of maybe 5 or 10,000 people, that will also be a part of our international rollout. And it's just worth mentioning because there may be some parts of the world where plastic waste isn't the main problem, and certainly the need for hydrogen isn't the most urgent priority. They do need electricity to bring themselves into the 21st century.
We haven't even talked about that benefit, have we? The fact that you could power, you know, tens of thousands of homes with a single facility, you know, a small town like you're describing, you know, with a small is beautiful, you know, local generating facility, especially for those places that aren't yet connected to the grid. And it's worth remembering that almost 1 billion people today lack access to any energy at all. And, you know, some forecasts suggest that that could be as many as 3 billion people by mid-century. So not only do we have to decarbonize our existing energy system, but probably double or triple it as well to meet that rising global energy demand. And again, the more that we can avoid having to make very large investments in associated transmission and distribution infrastructure, but to really locate the energy production close to where it's needed, that's ultimately going to reduce the overall investment that's required, but also create, you know, great opportunities for local ownership and power and energy generation that's anchored in local communities, which is empowering in many ways, in more ways than one.
We've been giving a pretty broad overview of where we hope to go. Just to bring it back now to the here and now, in first quarter of 2021, we are in a very strong financial position, having just raised more money. We are getting ahead with the process of constructing our first plant, and we will be reporting regularly during the course of 2021 about our progress, updating the website, and I'm sure, Kirsty, you and I will have another conversation at some point during Q2.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Looking forward to all this progress to come.